for a great warmth, which is also an important trait when in a person or anything else's character. And basically, this just for having a tremendous inspirational character and being far above and beyond the call of duty, we hereby announce and anoint and award this the Best Monday of the Year So Far award. I mean, nice weather. Fair and warm today and tonight. Partly cloudy and continued warm tomorrow is our forecast. High today and tomorrow in the upper 80s. Low tonight in the upper 50s. Southerly winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. I may get that little boat out in the water someday this week after all. At DFW Airport right now, we have fair skies and 72 degrees. It's already 76 in downtown Fort Worth and 75 degrees at Communications Center in downtown Dallas. We've got just a fabulous group of people coming here today, and I hope you'll stick around and meet some of them and call us and give us your thoughts as we talk with our guests. First of all, in just a couple of minutes, we'll meet Imam Wallace D. Muhammad, who is the leader, the president of the World Community of Al-Islam in the West. It's a long title, but this is the group that used to be known under the leadership of Wallace D. Muhammad's father, Elijah Muhammad, as the Black Muslim group in this country. Over the past several years, under Wallace Muhammad's leadership, the Black Muslims have been transformed into an Orthodox Muslim community, and we'll be talking about that transformation and the role of the World Community of Al-Islam in the West as they see it in the 80s, also their relationship to the Middle Eastern Muslim world, and try to gain a little bit of insight into the religious fervor that is sweeping Iran. In just a couple of minutes with Wallace D. Muhammad. A little bit later on, we'll be talking with a lady named Selma Ettenberg. She and her husband, several years ago, founded a camp in upstate New York, a summer camp for kids on the East Coast that's a little bit more popular and more normal, I think, for parents to ship their kids off to camp for summer than it is here. But Selma's camp is a little bit different than the other camps that you may associate from your childhood or from movies or television. This is a summer camp only for kids who are overweight. It might be called the last resort in some cases for kids, if you'll pardon the bad pun. And we'll find out how it works and what you might be able to do if you have an overweight youngster and you can't afford to send them all the way to New York for a summer camp. We might have some tips a little bit later on for you from Selma Ettenberg. And then last but certainly not least today, Pauline Kael, my favorite movie critic and certainly one of the most respected and influential movie critics in this country. She has out a new book, a collection of her writings over the past several years from the New Yorker magazine called When the Lights Go Down, and we'll be talking with her about her movie-going memories and also about some of the great and the not-so-great movies of the 70s, Jaws and Saturday Night Fever and 3 Days of the Condor and King Kong, and find out why Pauline Kael surprisingly prefers Animal House over Heaven Can Wait. That doesn't seem to me to be something that would fit in with Pauline Kael's thinking and her taste, but she says it does, and we'll find out why and also find out, pardon me, her reactions to the Oscar Awards of last week, and more a little bit later on. A busy morning, so let's play a few commercials here, pay the light bills, and we'll be back and meet Wallace D. Muhammad right after this.
Music. From country to rock to Bach. Music is big business in Big D. So big that recording studios here are rocking 24 hours a day, often 7 days a week. In fact, Dallas now ranks in the top 4 U.S. cities in commercial music production. No wonder. Dallas not only has the studios, it has the composers, the arrangers, the singers, the musicians, and it has a bank helping to orchestrate this success.
Well, it certainly isn't news to hear that things are messed up on Central Expressway, but right now it appears they're particularly messed up on Central Expressway, and here with a report, on the scene, Ray Lapeer.
Major tie-up right now here on South Central Expressway. It's located between Airline Road and Monticello. We have an overturned pickup truck in the southbound lanes. It's blocking traffic pretty well back north on southbound Central. If you're on Central, I suggest you get off, head over towards Greenville Avenue. That'll probably get you into town a lot quicker. Ray Lapeer in Unit 7.
12 minutes after the hour now at News Talk 57 WFAA. And here in our studio, a gentleman who told me just a few moments ago that the weather was so nice that he had decided to extend his visit in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for a couple of more days, just for business reasons. Imam Wallace D. Muhammad of the World Community of Al-Islam in the West. Good morning, Wallace.
Good morning, Kevin. Happy to be with you this morning.
I'm glad you could be here with us. I was disappointed Friday when you were a bit under the weather and our schedules didn't work out, but I'm delighted that you could come by and talk with us and enlighten us a bit about your religion and your work and maybe give us a little bit of insight into the Middle East. Can you clear me up on terminology, first of all? Is Imam, is that like reverend or rabbi in other religions?
Yes. Muslims, I'm sure there are Muslims listening to me in the audience out there, and they would appreciate it if I would, at least explain that there's no priesthood in our religion.
Mm-hmm.
The imam is just one who's qualified in the studies of the Quran and mm-hmm. in the life of Prophet Muhammad. And if he has the better qualifications, then he's qualified to lead the people in prayer and in the rituals
mm-hmm.
and to teach them their religion. So I'm an imam. An imam is equivalent to preacher, maybe. Preacher mm-hmm. or minister.
How do you get that qualification? Is there a governing board or a certification body or a theological school that you have to go to in order to become an imam or imam?
Traditionally, the imams have... Prophet Muhammad was our first imam.
Mm-hmm.
He's Prophet's first imam, too. He was our first imam. And those students who trained under him, they were qualified to teach others.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a school of imams. And some people follow one imam, Hanafi, and some will follow Hanbali, and some will follow another, about four or five major schools. And fortunately, we don't belong to any of those schools because that kind of traditional religion, al-Islam, the traditional Islam, I think has divided the Muslim world and has taken us away from our basics, the basics of the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's why we have this friction between Shiites and Sunni and these divisions, you know. So we don't subscribe to any of the schools, but we accept all the schools. And fortunately, we don't belong to any school outside of the United States, and we don't belong to any particular body of scholars or anything within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We have our own leadership.
You've kind of created this church in yourself, really. I mean, I know you would not accept all the credit, but many years ago, when people in this country first became acquainted with black people taking names like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Muhammad Ali, it was through the black Muslim church that your father, Elijah Muhammad, was the leader of.
Yes.
And you have transformed what some people consider to be a racist or black supremacy organization that said that, you know, white people were all white devils, into an orthodox Muslim community or Muslim community.
Yes. Actually, what has formed now as an organization for us is a result of my own personal struggle and experiences. My father, he led us into the separatist movement, Black Nation Islam, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My father was more than a race-conscious man. In fact, he was a religious man, too, just like I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed us to the Quran, which is a universal Bible, a book for all the Muslims. And what happened was I had to choose between the Quranic teachings and the old philosophy of the Nation of Islam. And in doing that, what happened was a lot of understanding of social reform and even symbolic interpretation of religious symbolism came out of my study.
Mm-hmm.
So what really our community leadership is a result of an enlightenment from the old kind of thinking that we had and an adherence to the basic teachings of the Quran, which really goes counter the old philosophy of separate races and all that. Yes.
That had to be really tough for you as a young man, because I'm sure there were lots of friends of your father and all your relatives that were saying, Wallace, you know, your father would roll over in heaven for you to be changing the community as you are.
Well, surprisingly, it didn't happen that way, and it was because actually in the last 18 months of my father's life, my father began to put me into the leadership. And he knew my thinking. In fact, when he pulled me in, I was outside. I had been excommunicated, and I was on the outside, but I always kept lines of friendship open, you know, and with my father and even with other members, leaders in the organization. So I would write my father.
What have you been excommunicated for? Because your beliefs
don't go along with theological differences.
Mm-hmm.
Theological differences, not accepting the same ideas about God. I accepted the Quranic ideas about God,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't hide it from my father. And my father didn't bother me until someone came and complained. So they came and they made a complaint against me openly, and my father had to excommunicate me. My father later asked me if I wanted to come back. And I had approached him before asking him to come back, asking him to allow me to come back, and he had refused, you know. But he heard a taping of a radio interview similar to the one we're doing here now, but not quite as popular in Chicago. And he listened to it, and he said, I saw him. He said, he got something there. He said, he's got something there. Mm-hmm. So he got interested in me again. He accepted me back. He made me minister in his headquarters. And from then on, I've been right in front, right up front.
I know if I came to you as a student and said, Imam, tell me about God, that we could talk for years, perhaps.
Oh, yes.
But can you give us, an audience, a basic view of the theology of the Nation of Islam, your ideas about God, the relationship that you might have to other religions and the Quran?
Yes, our concept of God resembles the Judaic concept of God, in that God is not possible to conceive him in any physical pictures or images. You know, there's no physical image for God. We can only know him through our spiritual experiences,
mm-hmm.
and not by direct experience.
It's like the old story of Moses, where
yes.
No one can look upon the face of God and live. Some theologians said that meant that it's just impossible to know God.
Exactly.
In a direct sense.
Yes, and he's one.
Mm-hmm.
One God. Our concept resembles the Christian concept in that he's a personal God. He's a personal God.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need Moses. We can go directly to God. Yes.
Do you have no other savior then? Like the first prophet Muhammad, it's not necessary for you to go through him like a Christian
no.
might go through Jesus in order to attain salvation.
No. I believe the two religions are agreeing, but the way we interpret it is different, you know. If God set a prophet up, we have to recognize that prophet, because we didn't come into the knowledge of the Quran directly. It came from Prophet Muhammad to us,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so we do have to accept him, and in accepting him, we come to God through him. But Prophet Muhammad told us to address God directly, not through him.
Your concepts of sin would be familiar to most people of Judeo-Christian ethic?
Exactly, certainly. Sin is disbelief. That's mm-hmm. the worst sin, is to disbelieve in God.
Mm-hmm.
And sin is ignorance to God. Many of us are sinning in ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Heaven and hell? Do those exist?
The same. Yeah. The same. Basically the same. Only we believe that both heaven and hell is continuous.
Mm-hmm.
We believe right now we are living in some degree in both heaven and hell.
And that really intensifies in afterlife, or?
Yes, well, if we believe once you die, you're resurrected the same as you were when you died. And if you weren't in heaven when you died, then you won't be in heaven when you're resurrected.
So reincarnation, although one might not be aware of it, is a part of your theology?
No, we don't believe in reincarnation. Mm-hmm. We believe in the continuation of life.
Okay.
That life does not stop, it continues. And this phase of life that we call the real life on Earth is just a breeding place where everything is born. You know, my conscience is born, my sentiments, my whole, I'm formed as a human being, a person, and my appetites are born. But the real place for fulfillment is in the new creation.
Which is sometime after.
That's right.
Out there.
And we don't argue about that. We just accept it.
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll after all, we'll never know until we get there what it's going to be like for sure. Wallace D. Muhammad is my guest at News Talk 57 WFAA. When we come back, I'd like to find out a little bit more about the schism in the Muslim world outside of the United States between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and also see what insight you can give us into the fervor and the upheaval going on in Iran and other parts of the Muslim world right now. Okay?
Okay.
Wallace D. Muhammad, the leader of the world community of Al-Islam in the West, is my guest at News Talk 57 WFAA. Wallace D. Muhammad, the leader of the world community of Al-Islam in the West, is my guest at WFAA. We're talking about the... I keep feeling odd about saying Muslim sometimes and Muslim sometimes. Is there a... Are those words just absolutely interchangeable, or are they...
Right. I think we're learning in the West by the name Muslim, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I have no objection.
Do they mean anything different?
No, the proper pronunciation is Muslim,
mm-hmm.
But I think the French gave it the name, the pronunciation Muslim.
And started spelling it differently.
Right. Right.
Muslim is the proper and preferred.
Then. That's right. Muslim.
Muslim.
It's S. Some people say Z, Muslim, mm-hmm. but it's not Z, it's S. Muslim. And mosque is French too, was given to us. If we say masjid, who knows us, you know? It's mosque.
In recent months, since the turmoil in Iran, people in this country who had never before heard of Shiites and Sunnis are now aware that there is a division in the Muslim world in the Middle East anyway. You you said that you're not part and parcel of that, but can you explain to us the difference between the Shiite and the Sunni and why they're so unhappy with each other, or where that schism originated?
Yes, it goes way back in the early history of the religion. There's a great man that we all love. Sunni Muslims and all Muslims love him very dearly. The relative of the Prophet Muhammad by the name of Ali. The Shiites, they give Ali a very special place that nobody else gives him in the leadership of the religion. And I heard that some Shiites give him a kind of a Christ role in the religion.
And the Shiites know the ones, the Ayatollah Khomeini and his followers are Shiites.
Exactly. And they believe that he should have been the Khalif instead of Abu Bakr or Omar. You see, he should have been given preference, but he didn't get preference. Abu Bakr wasn't a relative, he was just a dear friend and close assistant to Prophet Muhammad. He became the first Khalif, the first ruler after Prophet Muhammad. But later on there was a kind of a hierarchy of imams that was established, and they represented a kind of body almost like the apostles of Christ, Jesus, in Christianity. And they called the 12 imams. And I understand that the Shiites believe that one of those imams are still existing somewhere in some kind of mysterious form, alive, like I am, existing but unobserved, you know. And he's been existing like this, I think, for 500 years or more. This kind of idea is not accepted in the broad body of our religion, of our religious community, which is called Sunni. They represent the great majority of the Sunnis, you know.
Most Muslims worldwide are Sunnis.
Yes, and Sunni simply mean that they follow the way of Prophet Muhammad. They follow the pattern that he set, what he established in his life. They follow that. But the Shiites say, they claim to be Sunni too. They say the word Shia also means the way, and they say they're following the way of Prophet Muhammad. So it's a lot of confusion, you see. But I think what they've done is just mystified Ali a little bit too much for us and have made the ideas kind of Christian.
Was Ali the prophet who was martyred?
Yes, he was. Ali was. He was the leader. He never was no prophet. There's only one prophet, Prophet Muhammad. He was the leader that was martyred, but other leaders were martyred too.
But he was the one that the Shiites focus on.
Yes, that's right. And his son, his descendant from him, his name Imam Hassan, very dear to all of us. But to them, they have a place like in the leadership. They say, well, it has to be. The leadership has to come through the prophet's line. So they put more importance on blood relationship than most of us do.
What can you tell me about Iran?
Iran, to me, seems to be part of just a general awakening, reawakening, pardon me, in the religion. There was a great scholar who's passed now. He passed here recently. His name is Maulana Maududi. This scholar is from India. He's written many books on the religion and Islam. In fact, I've read several of his books, and in my own self-studies, I've benefited greatly from reading his books, taught understanding Islam, and many books that he wrote. But he was a kind of world leader too, and he says in one of his books that the Muslims have to understand that our religion is an ideology for changing the world, reforming the world. And I think he has had some influence on Muslims all over the world too. And I think perhaps Imam Khomeini, who had been developing all along, perhaps he started before Maududi, I think he must have been influenced too in some way by Maududi.
Because
Imam Khomeini, he's not, as I'm sure you're aware, he's not just saying to Iranian people, let's get our country back from the un-Islamic regime and influences of that regime, ex-Shah. But he's saying that let us transport this revolution
throughout the world.
Yes,
throughout the whole modern.
That's right. That's right. So what I see there firstly is people reacting to hurt, deep scars and deep wounds, and that's why the holding of the hostages there has gone for so long, because I don't believe there's enough rational vision right now.
Do you agree with observers that say that maybe they're just
just caught up in the zealot or the fervor of religious experience and pursuing the course of the Ali, that they want to become martyred, that in their particular thinking that the best thing they can do in their life to serve God is to martyr themselves in a losing cause, to pick a fight with a giant like the United States and be crushed?
Well, if there's too much insistence upon getting all that I want on each side of the negotiation, then I think that's what we really will have there, because those people, they are very zealous, for, as you say, believers, and they love the religion in a spiritual sense that is a little bit too much spiritual for most of us, you know.
It's hard for us. I mean,
yes, and I can see them becoming suicidal if a way is not open for them. And I just hope that our government will keep the moral integrity that he has displayed so far, and won't become dishonorable in its negotiations with the Iranian people. And I hope that we can be big and be sympathetic.
Well,
because they need a lot of sympathy.
If you were president, we put this question to a lot of people, if you were president right now, and knowing perhaps better than anyone else who's dealing with the Iranian situation on our side, what might be going through the minds of the Ayatollah Khomeini and his other leaders and followers, what would you do to get the hostages out?
I'll try to win the respect of Ayatollah Khomeini, although it might be impossible.
How would you go about winning it?
By acknowledging that his revolution was a just revolution, though we are not Muslims, we are Americans, and Americans are not Americans, we're not a Muslim country, but we respect a revolution that aimed at liberating the people from an oppressive regime who persecuted their religion. And I believe the president has done as much as I expect him to do to tell all people that Christians respect the legitimate religion of the Muslims, you see. But I think if we could go a little further and tell the people of Iran and the Muslims of the world that we also respect the revolution that put the Shah out of office there.
Carter, well, that's kind of his category of saying that would be apologizing to terrorists, and that he would never do that.
Well, we were terrorists too when we fought the British.
Yeah. Good point. 25 minutes before the hour, Wallace Stephen Hammett is my guest. We'd like to take your telephone calls this morning if you have any questions or comments about the Nation of Al-Islam in the West, or about the Middle Eastern situation. If you are curious and would like to be enlightened on any point having to do with their theology or politics, by all means, give us a call. In Dallas, the telephone number is 742-5700. Fort Worth and the Mid-Cities, you can call in at 263-4905, and the long-distance line is area 214-742-5761. Coming back, we'll talk a bit about the place of women in the Nation of Al-Islam right after this. 22 minutes now before the hour, WFAA, Kevin McCarthy and Imam Wallace D. Muhammad, leader of the World Community of Al-Islam in the West. A quick question, and then we'll take some telephone calls and perhaps talk a bit more about politics. But the place of women in the Iranian society, at least, has dramatically changed since the religious revolution. They have gone back to covering their bodies and their faces with veils and accepting what seems to be a very secondary role. What's the nature of women in the Western community of Al-Islam? Where do women fit into the religious theology?
Fortunately for us, under the leadership of Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he knew nothing about this special role for women in Islamic society, you know. So he encouraged women to come forward, although the male role and the female role was always kept separate, very separate, very distinctly separated. But he allowed women to come out front. Women addressed our national conventions. Women led their own community. Their own community was called the MGT. It was a kind of a class for orienting women, you know, in the community. So they had their own independent leadership. Women were allowed to work in businesses, to own businesses. In fact, our community was more Islamic regarding the treatment of women than so-called Orthodox.
Are they equal?
Are they equal?
Yeah.
Yes, they are equal.
So,
yes, but there is a area of inequality too. I have to go directly to the authority, and that's the Quran. The Quran says, men have a degree of superiority over women, and that degree is in their physical might, mm-hmm. and in the historical fact that they have amassed great wealth and power.
Mm-hmm.
So that degree can be taken away if something happens, trends change, and women become their leaders in the material world. That I don't know if we can claim that anymore, you know. But as long as men have that role, and I hope we continue to keep that role.
It's an honest man, ladies and gentlemen.
There's going to be a degree of superiority for us. But as far as inherent nature, we believe it's the same for both, yeah. Spiritual, moral, intellectual, everything.
A woman cannot be an imam.
She can't be an imam, but she can be a religious teacher.
Okay.
She can educate the people in religion.
Wallace D. Muhammad is my guest at News Talk 57-742-5700. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I'd like to extend the greetings to our leader, Imam Wallace D. Muhammad. And I'd like to encourage all the people of Dallas to listen to what this man has to say and the people of the world. Because truly he is one of the greatest leaders of this time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
742-5700 is available to you. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hello, I just wanted to check out a couple of things that I've come across that supposedly are based on the law of the Quran. If a couple commits adultery, that they both must be killed, that they had a ritual murder there not long ago, I believe in Saudi Arabia. And another question about the Quran is, when we talk about the laws that are in the Quran, if they're supposed to, they're supposed to cut people's hands off when they steal, and I have heard some very, very, very negative things.
There have been a lot of tales about the cruelty associated with
it. Now, too, if in the Quran it's permissible to maim a child to cut off its hand so that they can qualify to beg. These are all things that I've heard from more or less reliable sources, and I'd like to check it out.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Yes, we appreciate the question, because naturally we feel pressure, you know, when things like that are believed in our society. There is a lot of ignorance in the Islamic world. It's known among Muslim scholars and educators that most of the Muslims in Muslim countries are really ignorant as to what is exactly their religion, what their religion is. The punishment for stealing is correct, is cutting off of the hand. But the Quranic teaching does not say everyone who steals have to have the hand cut off. There's intelligence that is required. The judge has to be qualified. The judge has to be qualified in Islamic law. And whenever we read a law like that in the Quran, it always sobers that law with an expression like this: God is all-knowing and all-forgiving.
Mm-hmmm.
So the imam, who will handle a case like that, he knows that those words there are to sober him. And if someone was driven by poverty to steal, he wouldn't cut his hand off. He goes free.
Mm-hmm.
You excuse him. If he's helped and then he continues to steal, then his hand will be...
who have told me that stoning is Islamic. But I insist upon saying it's not Islamic, because nowhere in the Quran does it say stone a prostitute. It says lash both the male offender and the female offender, to lash them with a whip, to whip them publicly in the public, to shame them and disgrace them. But nowhere does it say stone them. Stoning was pre-Islamic. Prophet Muhammad did allow a stoning, but here is how he judged. Prophet Muhammad was not only a religious leader for Muslims, but Prophet Muhammad became a national leader for people who were in the Muslim government, in the Muslim society, for Christians, for Jews. So if a Jew offender came to him, he wouldn't execute the Quranic law on a Jew. Mm-hmm. He would execute the Jewish law on the Jew. He executed the Christian law on the Christian. And a lot of these harsh laws that we are saying that are calling Islamic laws, really something that we have taken on blindly from pre-Islamic days.
and the Jewish community have even graduated out of that, mm-hmm. and the Christians have graduated from it, but we, some of us, are still practicing those things, and it's ignorance.
The baby cutting their hand off so he could beg.
No, I never heard of that. That's insanity, and we'll find insanity everywhere, won't we?
What do you do, Wallace, when your religious laws and what you believe that God wants you to do conflicts with the laws of the nation? I can't think of any instance immediately where that would be likely, but when one's religion conflicts with the laws of the nation, how do you look to resolve that conflict? Can you think of an example that you might have faced?
Yes, I can. If I was in communist Russia, that would be a problem.
Right.
Yes, but in America, there's no problem because God, in directing us in the Quran, with Quranic teachings, Allah has told us that we can live, we can coexist with Christians,
mm-hmm.
we can coexist with Jews. Allah tells us in the Quran that the food of the people, the Christians and the Jews, are acceptable to you, and your food is acceptable for them. Now, it doesn't mean Christians and Jews who break their own dietary laws, but those who respect their own dietary laws that was given to them, that we can eat their food, they can eat our food, we can't eat pork.
Mm-hmm.
But it means they have to practice high, they have a high consciousness about cleanliness, about health, you see, and we can live in a society like that, we can coexist. But I think there's a hint also that, you know, bread in the Bible has two meanings. There's the food that goes into the physical body, and then there's the bread, meaning the doctrine,
mm-hmm.
the doctrine. So I think what it's saying that there is a strong bond between the doctrine of your people, and you can coexist together. And Allah says in the Quran, you'll find the nearest people in spirituality to you to be the Christians. Those people who call themselves Nasara, which is the people of Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
Some Muslims say, oh, that doesn't apply to these American Christians. But I say it does if they're trying to be sincere like the people of Nazareth. If we all are trying to be sincere, we can coexist together. And if the American law says something, I think we should respect that law. If the American law says one wife, we should respect that law.
Mm-hmm. Wallace D. Muhammad is my guest at News Talk 57. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I, too, wanted to welcome the Muslim leader to Texas. And I would like to ask, has the Carter administration talked with him for advice? And also, has he communicated with the Khomeini regime? I'll hang up and thank you very much. Nice to talk with you.
Very good questions.
No,
Jimmy Carter ever come to the head Muslim in this country and say, what can you tell me?
No. But I have had the good opportunity of meeting the president with the Black Forum,
mm-hmm.
And I find the president is open. He seems to be very honest, man, and he's open. I have been invited by the State Department and White House on other occasions where. The foreign policy regarding Islamic nations was one of the things that were discussed.
But not during the Syrian crisis, they never come to you and said, Wallace D., you're the head Muslim in the United States, what insight can you give us?
No.
That strike you as strange?
No, it doesn't, because the government has resources that we don't have. We don't have those resources. And I respect the judgment of the government. If they call on me, I'm ready, and they know that.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten that message across, and I'd be more than willing. In fact, I'm anxious to, if it's possible, to go and talk to Imam Khomeini himself, because I'm an imam, and he's an imam,
mm-hmm.
and I think we can talk together, and perhaps he could help me, and I could help him, maybe.
Have you talked with anyone in the Khomeini regime?
No, I haven't. I've talked to the Charles of the Affairs, who was in Washington, until, as you know, our government
mm-hmm.
asked him to go back home. I talked with him, and I was impressed because he's very sensitive. He seems to want to see America and Iran's relationship improved.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very, very sensitive to the hurt of his people, like the other Iranians I've talked to. And it's just a big problem.
Well, as it seems, you know, again, in this area, I'm ignorant. Maybe there's bad blood or something between the Ayatollah's brand of thinking and yours, but it seems to me that one of the logical ways to approach that problem, instead of sending Episcopalian ministers or Catholic ministers over when they did last November or December, that you would have been certainly an obvious choice to go as part of that delegation to try to communicate and find some basis for agreement and negotiation?
Well, you know, I think that propaganda from both sides has kind of misrepresented the facts, you know. And if I went over there, I would let him know that we have gained a lot as a Muslim community in America.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think we've gained more because of being a Muslim community in America than we could have gained otherwise. If we had been in Arabia or some other country, we couldn't have gained what we've gained. I don't think we could have gained the respect and really the enlightenment that we have gained from our own religion. I don't think we could have gained that enlightenment if we had been born in some Muslim country or just been part of some Muslim country. And America has so many things that are in common with our religion. The main spirit, the main aspiration in the constitutional language, the language of our constitution, is Islamic. It's really Islamic. I believe that the natural alliance in the world now is an Islam, a Christian, American, and Muslim alliance. That's what is needed in the world now. But Muslims will have to know their religion because mm-hmm. we haven't known our religion. And Christians will have to know the religion of Islam too. But we can come together and coexist, and that would be a great alliance. The world needs that kind of alliance. We don't need to put down God. We need to keep God.
It's one of the reasons many people say that in the 80s, with the emerging third world continuing, with the rise of the Nation of Islam worldwide, that you, as a man who is a black man, an American, and a part of the world of Islam, might well be the most influential religious leader of the 80s. How do you respond to that?
I don't know. That's too much for me to think about. I came from too small a background, you know. I just read recently that the man that I don't have too much respect for because of the 30 things I've heard about him, President Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
He says that Carter is losing the Third World War. The Third World War.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's losing it. Well, that hurts me when I hear something like that, because really, I hate to think that American people would think of the Third World War as a physical war or as an economic war. The Third World War is the war for the consciousness of the people. And the country, the nation that can get the faith of the people of the world, that's going to be the one that will win the Third World War.
We'll be back and take some more phone calls for Wallace D. Muhammad right after this. Before the hour, Kevin McCarthy and Wallace D. Muhammad at News Talk 57. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hi, Wallace, you've become a very popular guest on talk shows around here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to say up front, I respect your intelligence and your knowledge. I'm a Christian, so I don't embrace your religion. I'm not going to stop short of wisdom, but the rest of it I have to hand to you.
Well, thank you.
You said a few minutes ago that the Ayatollah overthrowing the Shah's regime was a just cause. And I would like to ask you, have you considered the fact, and I don't mean this in a hostile way, but have you considered that when the Shah was in power, if he was as bad as we now hear that he was, he certainly had within his power to have the Ayatollah assassinated while he was in exile in France, and he didn't do it. We never heard about the atrocities that the Shah supposedly committed, but we do have first-hand knowledge through satellite, etc., of the atrocities that exist in Iran right now. And when you compare those two, how can we believe that the Ayatollah Khomeini, particularly, is a just man and that the Shah was not?
Yes, well, what I'm going on is the information that has come from what we consider to be reliable sources, and several world bodies that investigate cruelties have made the same judgment, and that is that the Shah's regime was outrageously cruel, and that what has happened now, though it is not approved either, we don't like what has happened, it is more acceptable than, more morally acceptable than what the Shah himself was doing. Red Cross, World Peace, Peace Body, a body that represents world peace, and several other bodies, the international bodies, have investigated what happened there under the Shah. In fact, there were bodies that nationally respected bodies that had already made those judgments against the Shah's regime even before we came to knowledge of what was going on. And that is before the crisis developed in Iran. And they had appealed to the powers, the world powers, to get something done there to stop the Shah's persecution, cruel persecution of Muslims in his country. But perhaps we have to acknowledge that the Shah did bring about material improvements there in the society, and he did make improved education there in the society in Iran. But in doing that, what he did, he persecuted people for their faith. He persecuted the religion. And you know that religion for religious people is freedom. And the real meaning of freedom for them is their religion. And once you take away from them their religion, they don't have any more freedom.
Sir, thank you for your call.
Just one more thing.
Quickly, if you will.
Can you explain the rationale that now that the Shah is not in power, they're still holding our hostages? Certainly the Shah is not persecuting anybody now. And if Kevin McCarthy had a grudge against me, and he suddenly took you captive right where you're sitting in order to get back at me, would that be, according to anybody's religion, horrible? I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Well, we can't accept that wrong done is right. It's never right. It's never right to do wrong to anybody. The Quranic verse, I think, that applies here says, do not allow the hurt and bitterness inflicted upon you by those who rejected you from the law be a influence causing you to abandon justice. So we can't do that. Now, the Shah's regime, in effect, did eject the people from their mosque, that is, from their religious observances, as they wanted to observe the religion. I don't think it's so much the physical cruelty that was meted out to them because of their resistance that they put up against the Shah. I think the real, at the bottom of the problem is the persecution of the religion. And if he persecuted the religion and drove them, he denied them the freedom of their religion, their religious life, then they can't allow that bitterness to affect them in such a way that they then be guilty of the same kind of cruelties. It's not allowed.
Certainly never saw hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets, flagellating themselves in joy when the Shah was in power in Iran.
No, and I didn't like to see it. I don't like to see it at any time because it's not right. It's un-Islamic.
That's not part of Islam.
It's un-Islamic.
Can you continue with us for some more time?
Sure.
We'd love to continue. Wallace Dean Hill is my guest, the Imam, who is the leader of the world community of Al-Islam in the West, and we will be back and take more of your telephone calls at 742-5700 and 263-4905 right after a short break for the news. Still to come this morning, we'll be talking about a camp for overweight children and also no yachts in the...
What it says, you know, and that's what turns, you know, angers a lot of sinners because